Hey, Channel 9, we're here with a very recognizable face that you guys have seen many times before. Hey, Anders. And we are also here with Charlie Calvert. And we're going to discuss some of the questions that have come up now that there's a lot of information out there on C-Sharp 4 and go into some of the reasons that certain design decisions were actually made.
Yeah, hi. So I'm Charlie Calvert. I'm the C-Sharp community PM. And we've been posting quite a bit up on the web now, as Jason's saying, and I thought we try to give you some of the questions that we've been receiving on the web so that Anders would have a chance to explain some of the motivation behind the most recent features here. Why don't we start with some of the questions that have come up about dynamic? People are just curious about the motivation. Why exactly did we go ahead and add dynamic to the language? What was it we were trying to achieve? And then we'll drill into that a little bit after you have a chance to give the motivations for it.
Right. Well, I mean, I think, you know, the thing that's interesting about dynamic is that there's lots of stuff in .NET, obviously, that is statically typed. But there are things that aren't. There are things that we do day-to-day that have no static typing. If, for example, you're talking to dynamically typed code, like Python or Ruby or whatever, well, there's obviously no static typing for that code. If you're talking to the JavaScript DOM or the HTML DOM inside Silverlight, again, it's a completely dynamic environment. There is no static type information that could help us with types. But also things like XML documents without an XSD schema, or now, you know, with cloud services and whatever, you know, REST-based API or REST-based cloud services where it's really just some URL string and some payload, you know, but there's no WSDL schema or anything, and indeed REST in many ways is sort of like an uprising against the complexities of schematizing these things, right? Mm-hmm. So more and more we're seeing environments that are dynamic in nature that is important and imperative for enterprise apps to talk to. And now the challenge we have is in a sense we can help people do that more easily, or we can have the somewhat more painful way that traditionally has been in place, right? I mean, if you look at how to talk to a .NET object in a dynamic fashion, let's say you want to call a method named add on an object whose type you don't know. Well, now all of a sudden you got to do, you know, call the get type, and then you got to like do member info dot invoke of blah 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 blah, and pass in an object array of arguments and some flags that say how you want to bind, and it just gets to be very very messy and complicated, right? Yet if you're in a Silverlight scenario and you want to talk to some object dynamically, then you got to do similar but different incantations, right? And if you're talking to Iron Python, then it's similar yet different again. And there are sort of all these different ways that we make dynamic calls from statically typed code. And what we're really doing with the dynamic extensions is we're unifying it all on top of the work that you know, is called the dynamic language runtime, and the language extensions that we've added to C# 4.0 to give people an easier way and a uniform way to talk to dynamically typed code. And indeed, to build apps that are hybrid in nature, where you are as strongly typed as you can be, because that is, in my view, at least, always a better thing, you know, or most, almost always a better thing. So I'm not trying to be religious. but you don't fall off a cliff the minute you have to talk to something dynamic. You can just gradually ease into it. And the programming experience very much feels like and looks like normal code. And I think that's important. And it's going to get increasingly more important as you know, as we sort of weave this mesh of cloud apps that are very dynamic in nature, and combine them with sort of, you know, the big apps that we build using the .NET framework.
I think some people, just because they're We've kind of thrown them two things right in a row here. We added var in the previous version, which had type inference, which maybe some people get confused about the difference between var and dynamic. and exactly why we made these two different changes and what the differences them are, and
yeah.
and maybe talk a little bit more about being
sure.
strongly typed inside
right.
of the language and what we
right.
think about it and
right.
why we were willing to give some
right.
of that up for dynamic.
It is actually, I do see often the confusion between what's the difference between object and dynamic and var,
yeah.
right?
There
I mean, how many things, how many ways do we have to say things that sort of seem like they're similar?
Yes.
Well, so I think probably everybody understands what object is. Object is just the root of the hierarchy, and this is this class that everything derives from that has a handful of methods like equals and get hash code and whatever, and that if you have an object, that's all you can do unless you cast it to something more specific. Then there's var. Var is actually not a type at all. It is an indicator that says, I'm not going to say the type here. You infer from something else what the type is, please. And so var can only be used when declaring local variables, and it can only be used when declaring local variables that have an initial value. And var simply means that you're telling the compiler, please take that type that occurs over on the right-hand side of the equal sign and use it here.
It's
saving me the bother of stating the obvious, you know.
Right.
And so var can mean object, it can mean memory stream, it can mean input window or whatever, depending on what the static type of the value that you're initializing the local variable
with. And just to be totally clear to everyone, var is still strongly typed.
Var is absolutely strongly typed,
yeah.
yes. And you can sort of convince yourself of that by hovering over var in the IDE, and it will show you what the actual type is, the actual strong type. So that leaves dynamic, which is this new thing in C-sharp 4.0. And really, first order approximation, the way you should think of dynamic is it's the same as object. Now, it obviously isn't exactly the same as object, but in fact, the way it gets encoded in metadata is as system.object, but with an attribute on it that said, and oh, by the way, I actually meant dynamic here, but it is simply an object. Now, the thing that differs between the built-in type object and the pseudo type dynamic, if you will, is that when something is statically typed as dynamic, and you say dot on it, or you do a plus between something of dynamic type, then we evaluate that differently than we normally would have. When you say dot on something typed as object, well, we do the same thing that we do with any other statically typed expression or entity, as we go look in the class, and then we see what methods are available, and then you must say one of those, or else it's a compile time error. With dynamic, you can say dot, and then you can follow it by anything you care to, and then an argument list with any number of parameters of any type you care to, and we just package it up. And then at runtime, we go do the resolution. And if we can't find a method that satisfies, you know, the parameters that you gave in the method name, then it's a runtime error. So dynamic means do the resolution dynamically at runtime instead of statically at compile time. But other than that, this thing I'm holding here is just an object.
So it's not so much a type per se, it's more just a method to enable dynamic dispatch.
It is a type that only exists at compile time. Yes. And so it's tracked by the type system in the same way that other types are tracked. But at runtime, there is no such thing as dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything will have some runtime type that will be, you know, like typically something more derived than object. It could be just system.object, although a system.object is useless as a runtime. You can't do anything with it.
And then idynamic object that people would use. Could you talk a little bit about
sure.
the purpose of that? Just so
sure. People... So when we then go to do this dispatch that we do, or actually not we, but the dynamic language runtime, when it does its dispatch, it sort of has a couple of burned-in known destinations or paths that it can go through. If the thing you're dispatching to is just a normal CLR object, then the dynamic language runtime can do the same kind of reflection that you would have had to do, go find methods named add or whatever, you know, with so and so many arguments, and find the best match and then dispatch to that one. If what you're talking to is a COM object, it knows to do an idispatch to that object. But if what you're holding is something that implements idynamic object, then That gives us a user-extensible way of plugging into the dispatch mechanism. You can implement dynamic object, or you can implement iDynamic object yourself, or more typically what you will do is you will derive from a class called system.dynamic.dynamicObject, which has a bunch of virtual methods you can override, such as get member, set member, invoke, and whatever, and all of the different kinds of operations you can do on a dynamic object. And so you can simply plug yourself in there, and then you can do the member lookup or the dynamic dispatch yourself. And in a sense, you can say what it means to say dot foo or dot foo of 5,10 on an object, and do whatever is appropriate. And we've seen interesting. I was just really reading Nikhil Kotari's blog today about a little encapsulation of that builds a proxy for a REST-based or any URI-based web service and allows you to treat it as something you can make dynamic calls on. And when you do, it dispatches and packages up in a URL and formats the arguments correctly and whatever, and then interprets the result as JSON or XML or whatever. It's beautiful stuff. And that's the kind of stuff that, you know, you could never do with static typing, because it's about what it looks like to make the call, right? I mean, and that you don't get to control in an API. It's you know, well, you know, if you don't have static typing, then you're going to have to use a string or something or put it in quotes, right? But now you actually get to take it out of quotes and make it look like you're calling a method, right? Which
And just for people's information, so they'll know, we do have on CodeGower. You can reach it by code.msdn.com, and then if you pass in C# future as the final part of the URL there, you'll be able to download a number of samples there. Among them, one of them showing how to use iDynamic Object. So other questions have come up about optional parameters now, because that's another. We have named an optional parameters here. And why did we introduce that into the language? Why aren't we just sticking with overloads as a method of working with multiple parameters?
Yeah.
And what are some of the dangers that perhaps we missed there to keep the syntax simple for people?
Well, first, the thing that's interesting about optional and named parameters is that the platform has had support for those ever since day one, because Visual Basic has always supported them. And it's just one of those requests that, you know, every version we keep getting, and it's one of those that sit, you know, consistently in the top 10 or even top 5. It is also, in particular, our lack of optional name parameters has been a big issue for COM interoperability and talking to the office automation models, where for not so good reasons, we have APIs that take between 15 and 30 arguments, you know, that were never intended to be all specified. Rather, the intent was that you would specify a few of them using named parameters, right? Or you would omit, and you would omit all the other optional ones, except since C# did not support that, you had to say all 30 of them, and it turns into this maddening exercise of writing a gazillion type.missings or whatever. So by popular demand, you know, we have caved in on our principle of not supporting it, and sort of done the design work to add it as a meaningful language feature. And I think it's come out quite nicely. There are a couple of things that we still don't do, like we support optional parameters, but you can only omit them by omitting them from the end, so to speak. So we do not support positional optional parameters where you go foo of 10, ...7, for example, and you have no idea what that means. You can only omit. You can only omit from the end, so to speak. You can't omit in the middle. And then once you've omitted at the end, then you can supply named arguments for the rest, which will give you an indication of which one it was, and you don't see this string of commas, you know. So it's sane in that sense. And actually, it very much, I mean, it looks exactly, I mean, a very typical pattern in that people have done, you know, because we didn't support optional parameters, is that you have all these overloads where you omit more and more arguments, and then you just call sort of the master method that takes all of the arguments, and you call it just with the default values, right? And really, in a sense, we're just automating that. We're just saying, well, hey, you can just supply the default values in the declaration, and then we'll allow you to omit, and then we will supply those arguments for you instead. But it looks and feels just as if you had a family of overloads where you're omitting arguments starting from the right, you know. So.
And then some people get confused here about with optional parameters in COM, interop will probably get IntelliSense, but there are other cases with dynamic where we would not get IntelliSense, or can you like straighten that out a little while when IntelliSense will be there and when it won't?
When doing dynamic dispatch, it's dynamic, and that means we do not have type information, and that means we cannot show you statement completion or IntelliSense for something. So whenever you have something whose static type is dynamic, and you say dot, you will not see a dropdown. But otherwise you will, and indeed, IntelliSense in C# 4.0 and then the C# 4.0 IDE is optional and named parameter aware, and will show you, you know, what parameter name you could give here, and what type that is, and so forth. So,
so you will see it. In
whenever we can, we will. Now, we could actually, over time, it's not likely to make it into C# 4.0, but one thing that we've discussed is having a feature that colorizes dynamic calls differently so that you can recognize them in your code. And that, I personally think that would be quite a nice feature, you know, mark the dot differently or make it a bigger dot or pulsating or orange or what have you, your radioactive sign or who knows what, right? But that's something that we may look at doing in the future. I should also say that if you are concerned about accidentally using dynamic or whatever, it will be quite easy to turn that feature off. Actually, not turning it off, but what you can do in your project is simply omit the reference to the C# dynamic binder, which will sit in its own assembly. And if you omit that one, then the minute you try to do a dynamic call, you'll get a compile time error. So we'll make it easy for you to just opt out of this stuff. I should also say, just as a matter of programming principle, just because we're introducing dynamic doesn't mean that we are telling people to run out and make all their static code dynamic. That is not at all the intent of the feature. Rather, it is filling in a lacking capability, you know, that augments the ability to write static code. But hey, if you have, or static type code, if you have static typing, I mean, I would still, as a rule, that's the way you should go.
Right.
You know, it is just for those cases where truly you do not have types.
What about the, I know that sometimes when you're working with Office, there's two questions in here. When you're working with Office, you might have some strongly typed parameters into a call, and then all of a sudden you'll reach one of the parameters that's declared as type object or something. Can you explain a little bit to that, people, and then maybe lead that into a Nopia explanation?
Sure.
You can.
So the Office automation models and other Olay automation models have this funny phenomenon that we refer to as peter out typing. You know, a lot of them are sort of semi-strongly typed. You know, they're strongly typed in that they declare a bunch of, well, not classes, but co-creatable objects, you know, that have type information in type libraries. But then all of the methods in there just return variant, you know, or something that effectively is dynamically typed, right? And so as you dot through them, the types sort of peter out and you end up with just something that's dynamic, and then you do dynamic dispatch from there. And it's a very common programming model in VBA. Indeed, you sort of often see code where you introduce a bunch of temporary variables where you go you go dim something as document equals this, and then dim the next as cell equals the result of calling document.getRange or whatever. And so you sort of reintroduce the type every time around. And then there are all these funny patterns that now be, you know, that were the intended use of the API, right? And the way we've introduced dynamic into the language, you can program in that intended fashion now. And it cuts down on a bunch of places where otherwise you'd have to put all these maddening typecasts in your code that talks to Office automation, right? Or other automation libraries. So now the Nopia feature, And PIA here, for those of you who don't know that abbreviation, means a primary interop assembly. One of the things that has characterized interoperability with COM up until .NET 4.0 is that in order to talk to an Olay automation server, you must have some strong type information for that, and you could create that with this tool called TLBIMP that imports a type library and creates you an assembly for it. But the problem was that if everybody ran TLBIMP themselves on, then you end up with hundreds of versions of the same information, and that was just complete madness. And so we introduced this concept called primary interop assembly, which really is a pre-runned version of TLBIMP that we produced and then ship along with the product. Now, the problem with these primary interop assemblies is that at least for the office automation models, they're big in the megabyte range, you know. And now it's we sort of have this unfortunate situation that when you start using office automation, you have to bring in, even into your running app, this 5 megabyte of metadata overhead, just so you can call one method out of the gazillions that are in there, right? Now, the NoPIA feature basically says that you still have primary interop assemblies. They're still there at compile time. But then at compile time, the compiler will take those few things that you used out of the interop assembly and put them into your assembly. And then you can forget all about the primary interop assembly afterwards. So it's, in a sense, a feature that instead of making reference to the primary interop assembly, it copies metadata out of there and puts it into your assembly, and then you're good to go all by yourself thereafter. And that makes, you know, your executables or your libraries much, much smaller, and they'll load faster, you know. So that's really what that feature is about.
Okay, why don't we switch over here and start talking a little bit about covariance and, mm-hmm. and contravariance. There's a couple different questions that I think people have had around this subject. One is, why doesn't it happen automatically? Why did we have to use this in and out keywords? Yeah. Why couldn't we just say, all right, we'll put it in here automatically? And right. I think people also had some questions about whether you can put in and out on the same variable, whether you can ever do that. So two questions there about covariance and contravariance.
Right. It is true that that we could actually infer from the declaration of an interface whether a particular type parameter is used only in input or output positions, and we could then simply by inference make that either co or contravariant. The problem with that approach is that you might end up with unintended co and contravariance as you evolve your interface. Let's say you're writing an interface and you start out, you know, by happenstance, just using a particular type parameter in input positions only or in output positions only. Yeah. If we were to just automatically then make it, contra or covariant, then you might write code that depends on that co and contravariance. When you then go add yet another method to your interface that now ends up using the type parameter in the other position, like both, such that you now have both input and output for that type parameter, well, then we would infer an invariant type parameter, and now we might break all sorts of other code that you had written. So we feel it's important that you indicate explicitly whether you intend the type parameter to be co or contravariant. Because it gives you that flexibility in, you know, it so happens that I'm not right now using it in both positions, but I intend to.
Yeah.
And so we allow you to capture the intent, you know, in this fashion. Now, with respect to could you have both in and out on a type parameter? Well, you shouldn't think of them as allowing. In a sense, in and out are restrictions, they take away capabilities. When you say in, it means you can only use it in input positions. And when you say out, it means you can only use it in output positions. If you don't say anything, it means that you can use it in both input and output positions. Yeah. So that capability we do have already, but you cannot be safely co or contravariant if you are using a type parameter in both input and output positions. You could be co or contravariant only then if you injected dynamic type checks in the code. And we do not want to go there because that has performance implications, and we would have to generate code stubs, or it gets very complicated and really, in a sense, it's an untenable feature to go implement. So what we have is safe co or contravariants, and with safety in mind,
you
can't do that.
All right, that was really the major questions we wanted to ask. I don't know if you wanted to, have you had any summations you wanted to put up, or if you wanted to talk any about the coevolution theories at all, or anything else you wanted to say here, if that's where you really wanted
to. Yeah, no, I think the coevolution thing is actually interesting to talk about. I have a slide on it in my PDC presentation, and it's something that we've talked to people about also,
in
blogs and whatever, And it really boils down to us sort of making a commitment going forward to co-evolve the Visual Basic .NET and C# programming languages, meaning that we're in a sense just recognizing what customers have asked us for all along. And that is, whenever we go add a feature to one of the languages in order to perhaps precision it for a different customer group, then the other camp immediately comes running going, we need that feature too. The reality is that in many ways people's choice of C# versus VB is more rooted in history than technical reasons, right?
Yes.
And the two customer groups are very similar and write similar kinds of apps and need similar facilities, to write those apps. And so we're recognizing that, and we're in a sense pledging to co-evolve the languages. Now, of course, you can then go debate, well, what does it mean to co-evolve? Well, to us, that means we're gonna work hard. If we put a feature in one language, we're gonna work real hard to have that same feature or a very similar feature in the other language. Now, I'm, for example, not gonna promise here that C# will get XML literals, for example, which is a feature that's in VB but not in C#. Because there is a perfectly good alternative solution, I feel, in C# called, nested constructors for link to XML that works really well. And we have a little plugin that allows you to paste XML as the code to create the XML. And so you get very, very similar capabilities, but it looks different. And each language will always have its own personality. But there are other features, like, for example, iterators in C# that haven't been in VB. And it's a royal pain to write an iterator if you don't have compiler support for it. And that we're going to try to work on, going forward. So we're going to make it so that if one language can do something, it's not going to be a royal pain to do.
So the iterators will probably show up in VB.
That is, I believe, the plan. Yes.
That's great. A lot of people asked for that.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thanks for your time, Anders.
My pleasure.
Our channel miners will love it as usual.
Yes. Good to hear.
And thank you as well, Charlie.
Sure. Thank you, Jason, for coming and doing this. It's wonderful.
It's an absolute pleasure. Well, until next time, we'll see you niners later.